Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Science is in a state of limbo. Not all that long ago, science was the crusader for truth. But there are many crusades these days challenging for power. So is this affecting the status of science writing? Will the science writers of our time be up to the challenge of making the case that things need some serious attention? Can their words ring the clarion call to action? You'll find out when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Science, for many years, reigned supreme as the decipherer of truth. Facts once had real meaning, but truth and facts are being morphed into the science of spin, and the effects are felt in every quarter. So, what is happening to the science writers? We find out now, as our in-depth look at oceans continues. All my life I've been intrigued by science. I'm a science guy. I like nature. I like to read about it. I like to get my fingers involved in it, and that's just the way it's been. And historically, there have been some really great legacy areas of science reporting. From my own perspective, quite honestly, some people will think this is funny, but I actually think that Walt Disney did a terrific job in terms of inspiring people to really love the Earth and to get a perspective of its complexities. But the more we learn, the more we realize just how complex nature really is, and that may be part of the problem, and that is that it's difficult to provide in any single venue or article or feature enough information to really have people appreciate just how complex this is. Well, someone who works at that on a regular basis is my guest now. Christina Reed has been published in Scientific American, The New Scientist, Nature Magazine, some of the best. And Christina, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you, Sydney. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you graduated from college apparently in what, 1999? Is that right?
I graduated from my undergraduate in 1997 in oceanography, And then went on to do two masters at Columbia University in a dual master's degree program on earth science and journalism, And graduated from there in 99.
Well, since that time, apparently the writing side has really, really worked for you. What is it that about science writing that you find so meaningful?
Oh, it's so much fun. I mean, you can just explore anything that strikes your curiosity. So like you know, you go, what's that? How does this work? And you go off and you find out, and then you get to share that with other people, the public, and explore all sorts of different avenues for research and the things that people are doing that all over the world in different subjects. My primary interest is in earth science and marine science, so that's where I've been focusing most of my stories.
What do you think is the state of the art in science writing right now? Is it getting better? Is it getting less? Is there enough of it? Give us an overview.
Oh, the state of the art in science writing is becoming tremendously popular amongst writers. It's avenues, scientists are actually turning to avenues of science writing more frequently than what was done in the past. Primarily when science writing first started out, it was to cover issues like the Apollo race and areas where there's these huge targets for space sciences, and reporters from newspaper sections like the Metro section would be pulled into covering science. And today you see a lot of people having more background in science coming into journalism. And that's fabulous because it allows for a greater in-depth knowledge of the subjects. You can get better questions. And at the same time, there's still this curiosity-driven reporting in terms of what's happening on our planet, what's happening outside our planet, what's happening all over the universe and in our galaxies and everything, and finding out how things work and what makes life tick.
I'm a science guy. You're a science girl, if I may. And But not everybody is, and I think that's part of the problem. I love science. I grew up, it's just to know the truth and to understand how things work. But I'm just curious, it seems as if, to me, as if somehow science's wonder and power has diminished somehow over the years with all the competition for other exciting things, whether it be video games or who knows what all. I'm just curious what your thoughts are in terms of the capacity for science writing to really meet the needs of communicating some of these issues that are so radically important right now.
I think science is to many people considered this huge mystery, and it's really sad when to think that students that are fascinated with science and how things work when they're young start to get scared of it when they get older. And as an adult, you think, there's so many other things that I have to do in my life, and knowing how one thing works over another is not necessarily as important to sort of day-to-day activities sometimes. And yet, there's the science research, the society in general supports the outcome of the research, supports the video games, that work, the Blackberries, the iPods, all the stuff that without science wouldn't be available. So there's this recognition that science does provide some cool things that can be done on a daily basis or applied to daily life. But there's this black cloud hanging over how things go from research and development into something you can hold in your hand and really use on a daily basis. So I think society and the general public shouldn't be as scared of understanding what's going on, behind the Wizard of Oz screen of magic of science. It's not all that complicated. It can be, but it shouldn't be so imposing in terms of what's happening out there.
It's no secret to people like yourself and actually a lot of other people that nature is in some form of decline. In many cases, it's the science writers who are bringing this message forward that otherwise it doesn't get much play. But that's difficult for a lot of people. They really don't want to hear that. I know in years past, science writing was very often dealing with the wonder, the joy of things. And quite honestly, that wonder is still there. And then, of course, there's this need now to talk about the challenges. And I know this is something that you're very concerned about. How do you balance? What would you recommend in terms of balancing the wonder, which inspires people in science writing, and then as well reporting about the challenges?
This is very difficult because nobody wants to hear that nature is, that the world is in trouble, but it is. And the way to get it, the messages across is to do so in a personal way, to make the stories personal about the researchers that are involved, to look at how we can do this, continue with directions that we've been taking in terms of our use of natural resources, and yet do it in a sustainable manner so that people don't have to suddenly stop everything that they've done in their lives and change dramatically, but just progressively, so that you look at your usage of electricity and natural resources and pollution, and you make it an individual choice to try and reduce those, and then help nature out by recognizing that there is a limit to what we have, how much time we have on this planet, and to make use of that time to the best of each individual's ability. And I think as a reporter, I like to take stories that show this personal interest, show the personal exploration that science and scientists are doing, and make that real to the readers. I think that when you have students and adults, and my audience is typically anywhere from grade school to my grandfather, who is a very big fan, you have to make sure that everyone understands, the importance of the subject matter and how it can relate to them, and why it's necessary, really, to know. I think that when you get those messages across, you're really starting to reach out to the audience.
a lot of your audience, for example, in Scientific American and New Scientist, these are people who are very much involved in the sciences. But if you had to reach out to a very mainstream America, people who are just kind of living their lives and science plays its role, how do you speak to them to get their attention?
I like to take the mystery and sort of unravel it. So usually it's a mystery to begin with. The science is a mystery. It's a huge mystery. And to me as well. So I like to take this mystery and make it like, crime scene investigations or something where, okay, this scientist is doing this to find out how this works. This scientist, so how does that, you set up the scene where that scientist is, how they stumbled on this discovery or their interest in the subject, and then explore their route of investigation. And it becomes this dialogue between the reader and the scientist almost in terms of what's happening in the exploration of the subject matter.
Trying to reach that aha moment.
Yes, exactly. You're trying to reach that aha moment. Ah, I get it now.
That's it, yeah. Which is, then all of a sudden something happens, you go, that is really fascinating. And that's perhaps what we need to do is try to get more people to say, that is really fascinating. Science certainly is.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, when you have your readers going, oh, that is really fascinating, then you know you've hit the mark.
Absolutely. One of your main concerns are oceans. Since you are an oceanographer and you're concerned about ocean reporting, what do you think? How is that progressing? Oceans are a difficult subject in some respects to really write about for a variety of reasons. One is the fact that, like, for example, where I am right now, I can see the ocean, and it's this wonderful blue thing out there. But I can't see what's happening underneath the ocean, and unfortunately, many people perceive the oceans that way. How can we penetrate into the wonder of the ocean to bring that forward? In terms of science
scientists
writing.
Scientists are still trying to figure that out. They, you can't, with GPS, for example, everyone can go on the surface of the planet and say, I am at this location at this point in time. But once you go under the oceans, those satellites can't reach you. So you're using other tools and other abilities once you're underwater to be able to figure out where you are to try and hunt down a seamount or a volcano, underwater volcano, and then explore that region. The oceans are this huge blue mystery in so many ways to so many people, not just to the general public, but to the scientists as well. And I think as a reporter, getting that information out, what do we know, and making sure that you're not making an assumption that we know everything, because we really don't. But it's there's so much exploration that still needs to be done. And I think the best thing that science writers who are covering the ocean sciences can do is recognize that there's still so much left for us to learn.
What do you think right now, 2006, are some of the key ocean stories that should be covered more fully?
Well, we've had a number of ocean stories come out as a direct result of the hurricanes, recent hurricanes, and the tsunamis earlier, and I think that for this year, what we need to do is have the public understand sort of the interaction between the oceans and climate. I also think that for 2006, that we need to have a better sense of how our direct actions, miles and miles and miles away from the beach, impact the oceans. And it's downriver pollution, but also farming and agricultural nutrient runoff. So farmers who can change their farming habits to more sustainable, less nitrogen fertilization, there's some techniques where you can use satellite GPS to recognize where in the farms need more fertilization, so you can pinpoint direct areas where such fertilization would be a benefit, and then instead of just mass fertilizing and things like that. And so pollution is a huge issue right now. Oil spills are what people typically think of, but that's the non-point source, which is not just like something happens here or you have a sewage outflow, something happens here to affect the ocean, but something happens gradually and over time and sort of all over. And so what happens is that it's everyone's impact on the ocean, not just one person's mistake or one person's decision. It's it's a huge society's action, and each person that can take more responsibility for reducing their own pollutant aspects of life, I guess, are helping out the oceans.
If you were to think out, we'll say 5, 10, and 20 years, what do you think the stories may be in 5, 10, and 20 years?
Well, we'll still, in 5, 10, and 20 years, we'll still have overfishing as an issue, because that's been going on since the time refrigeration was invented and allowed trains to carry fish further inland to feed societies. And in fact, there are some ties to how Europe's societies have grown over fishing as a result of having more protein in their habits and food sources and whatnot. But I think we'll see, if we can, my hope is that we'll see these stories being written with how our marine protected areas are now tourist areas that people can come, and it's this beautiful area that will have protected fish, and that the fishing, overfishing questions will be more along the lines of, this is 20 years down the line, how to protect the pods. They'll have fishing in these cages where they put the larvae of the fish in cages off in the coast of Maine and allow it to drift in currents along the way until and when the fish are then mature, by the time they get to the next port in Europe, then they'll be able to be released from the cage and consumed. So these are really far out there ways of looking at it, but not too far because they're currently being tested in Hawaii and off the coast of Massachusetts and New Hampshire. There's research into how we can sustainably harvest fish in the ocean instead of using fish farms in the beaches and things like that. So those stories will be interesting to follow. I think that hopefully, well, climate change is going to be a huge story in 20 years because we'll know how it's affected us. The increase in global warming is actually, it's a climate change perspective. In some areas, you're getting warmer. In some areas, things are happening differently, drier. You have El Nino coming back and forth, and the change in the Atlantic Ocean, there's these decadal oscillations in how the ocean actually works. So, and that impacts the atmosphere. And as things change, that impacts the fishing. That impacts the life in the ocean. That impacts all the life on land and how we react to it. So there's a number of interconnections, and I think those interconnections will be explored for 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the line.
We hear the stories that 90% of all the mature fish are gone from the oceans.
Yes.
And that, to me, is really difficult.
Fish.
Yeah, that's correct. Really difficult for me to it's not that I can't comprehend it. It's just that it hurts to think about it.
It does hurt. It does hurt to think about it. And it's also, there's this fishing technique. So if you go after the largest fish in the ocean, the fish in response are going to, you know, evolve to be smaller because they don't want to be caught. It's natural selection, and humans are impacting it directly. And if we could go to these fish pens, that would, I think, be helpful because then at least there's, and recognize that maybe we shouldn't be fishing for the largest fish. Maybe we should be trying to find out new and novel ways to make sure that we can obtain the fish sources, and that is so important to so many people around the planet in terms of their cultures, in terms of their food source, but do it in a sustainable way that allows for fish to mature not just to a specific size but to larger sizes and not so. And I think fish farms that are these floating pens around the ocean are an interesting novel idea, a novel way to try and manage that. I think that we need other people to come up with new ways as well. And one of the problems that is happening with our old ways in terms of like fishing lines is that you get cut fish lines will entrap and they'll just float in the ocean. And there's this interesting story, actually. It's kind of scary. There's an expedition last year to the Southwest Pacific, and researchers in a submersible Pisces 5 were in danger from fishing lines that had wrapped around this volcano. And so not only are you diving on a volcano already, so that's, you know, pretty dangerous, but then you have to worry about the fishing lines that are these spider web-like things that could snag the submersibles, and it could snag the submersible's motor, its propulsion system.
Mm-hmm.
So you're getting these scientists that are down there not only on a volcano that's already hazardous to be working on, but then you have these spider webs of fishing lines that can snag the propellers and propulsion systems and really cause damage to the submarine. And these ghost nets, as they're called, also when they float in the oceans, they continue to catch fish, even though no humans are around to pick them up. And those dead fish will then attract predators that will then get snagged in the ghost nets as well, and more predators. So that you have this huge ecosystem of death floating through the ocean that's a direct result of fishing lines that have just been left.
I guess part of the problem is the fact that somehow people don't seem to care if it's just fish that are dying. I think that's just part of the problem. We're suffering the consequence of our own message, and that is that, for example, you know, fish don't have feelings, that they don't experience pain, and therefore, well, if it's just a fish, who cares? Something like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that we have to remember that the food web, the food chain, the big picture is that everything has an impact, and when something on that seems small and insignificant starts dying off on extreme numbers, then you have to worry about how that impacts the rest of the food web. And we are sitting there enjoying most of it, and yet killing it off at the same time. And we need to know, how do we make sure that our impacts on the food web are not going to damage the rest of it as well, and the interactions that happen in the food web. So if we are killing off our fish for our own benefits, then we kill off the sharks, and we kill off the whales, and we kill off ourselves. It's just one thing after another.
Who are some of your favorite writers right now, and what makes them a good writer? What do you like in a science writer?
Oh, science writers who are doing a great job right now are the New York Times has... Cornelia Dean used to be the former editor of the Science Times, and she's now back on the reporting end, but she's written a book on coastal erosion called Against the Tide, The Battle for America's Beaches. Mm-hmm. And she's also working with Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer Bill Broad, who has written a book on The Universe Below, Discovering the Secrets of the Deep Sea. And Bill Broad and I share the adventure that is... something that you experience when you go down to see the hydrothermal vents that are happening on the bottom of the ocean floor. We were both able, not together, but Bill Broad was in the Alvin submersible, and I've been in the Russian Mir submersible for an expedition to see these hydrothermal vents, and they're phenomenal. They're absolutely amazing. I think that other reporters are... the Seattle Times are doing a good job. The Times Picayune, oh my goodness, they've won many awards recently, but they were covering the hurricane aspects of New Orleans, the levees, the issues with the levees, and the ocean interactions between the climate and the sea for many years. For many years they've been doing this, and it's frustrating because, you know, this is one part about science reporting where you put your heart and soul out there, and you say, we have to, you know, change things. We have to do something different. And if it's you're hoping that other people will hear the message and then take action. And it's so frustrating and devastating when not enough action has taken place. So I think there's a lesson there in terms of listening to the science writers that are out there. Also, we're seeing a lot of good reporting from The Economist and from Wired. Wired is considered a technology magazine, but they've been focusing many feature stories on the ocean research. And I think the story that I'm thinking about in Wired is specifically the research on these ocean pins, these free-floating ocean pins.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a really great magazine that few people will probably know about. It's called Oceanus, and it's published by the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. One of the best ways to find out what's going on in the ocean is to get your story straight from the source. So the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution has a website called Dive and Discover, and I've written for them in the past. They're now finishing up their 10th expedition. They're coming back from Antarctica, where they donned dry suits and scuba equipment to figure out what was going on with the marine ecosystem that feeds Antarctica's struggling penguin population. And if you've seen March of the Penguins, then you know how difficult it is to be a penguin on Antarctica. Other websites, if you're interested, are NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, has a website that goes straight out with scientists. Scientists and science writers are out there on the oceans reporting on a daily basis what's happening while they're out at sea. So if you go to these websites, you can find out, okay, what's happening now? What's happening right now as we speak out in the oceans? Who's looking at what? You can figure these out by going to NOAA's website. InterRidge has one. SeaWeb is also a good website for advocacy issues if you're interested in advocacy. They look at the science that's being done and then figure out what advocacy is the best based on the science.
Christina Reed, I want to thank you so much. You write regularly for Scientific American, New Scientist, and Nature. And where can we look for you in the future? Same place? And do you have some new adventures ahead?
Yes, always looking for new adventures. I'm working on a couple books that should be out in the fall or early next year on Earth science history and marine science history during the 20th century.
Who's putting that out?
Facts on File. They're going to be high school textbooks, actually.
Wow. Well, you're very aggressively moving forward. Christina Reed, thanks so much. It's been a joy talking with you.
Oh, this has been fun. Thank you so much, Sydney.
Thank you. Bye. Science writing. We need a lot more of it. We need to pay attention to it. If we had many years ago, perhaps we would not have such sorrow-filled science reporting today. I encourage you to pick up the March-April edition of Mother Jones Magazine, where these and other stories are covered in their special ocean edition. This is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios until next Thursday or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth speaks out here on the Wild Side News.